Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Talking Tudors, episode 76, and the sixth installment of our All Things Boleyn series. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and I'm so glad that you could join us today. Apart from our weekly podcast episodes, this month I've also published a wonderful Anne Boleyn drawing tutorial by artist Catherine Holman, and three guest posts by Wendy J. Dunn, Adrian Dillard, and Henry VIII himself. I also interviewed the brilliant Professor Susanna Lipscomb and asked her all your burning questions about Anne Boleyn. Our video chat is published on my YouTube channel, On the Tudor Trail. You'll also find links on my website, www.onthetudortrail.com. Now, before we move on to this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful listeners who continue to support this podcast via Podbean Patron, and thank everyone who's taken the time to rate and review the show. Your support and encouragement is very much appreciated. If you'd like to become a Talking Tudors patron, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family, and in addition to receiving lots of Tudor goodies, you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. In keeping with our Boleyn theme this month, May's prize is Anne Boleyn's Most Happy Portrait Pendant in bronze, made by the ever-talented Lucy Churchill. Lucy's reconstruction of Anne's portrait medal, which is the only contemporary likeness of the Queen to survive, is based on extensive research and is truly exquisite. Thank you to Lucy for sponsoring this incredible prize. I'd also like to invite you to join our Talking Tudors Facebook group, where you can chat with other Tudor history lovers and participate in regular Talking Tudors live chats. The next one is scheduled for the 30th and 31st of May, depending where you are in the world, so please join us if you can. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about Anne Boleyn's coronation procession is my partner in books, Sarah Morris. Sarah grew up on the edge of the beautiful Yorkshire Dales in England. She's an historic researcher and author and a blogger. Le Temps Viendra, a novel of Anne Boleyn, was her first published work of historical fiction. She's inspired by the life of stories of strong and courageous women who defy convention, women who remained true to themselves and their sense of purpose in often incredibly trying circumstances. Since publishing this book, Sarah has become a specialist in writing and blogging about Tudor places. She runs the very popular The Tudor Travel Guide blog, dedicated to being the time traveller's intimate guide to the castles, manors, and places of the Tudor era. Non-fiction books which Sarah has published in this genre include In the Footsteps of Anne Boleyn and In the Footsteps of the Six Wives of Henry VIII, both co-authored with myself. Do check out Sarah's blog, The Tudor Travel Guide, and her YouTube channel by the same name. My conversation with Sarah straight after this musical break, courtesy of singer-songwriter Carlene. The song, Born to Be Your Queen, is from The Ballad of Anne Boleyn, Carlene's best-selling album, inspired by the life of Henry VIII's second queen consort, Anne Boleyn.
Make me your wife, your one and only. I'll give you everything you need. I'll give you sons, I'll give you glory. For I was born to be your queen. When they refuse and they oppose you, remember remember God is in your being. You are the king and you must tell them true that I was born to be your queen.
Back to Talking Tudor. Sarah, how are you?
Oh, hello, Natalie. It's lovely to be back again. And I'm well, all things considered. I'm actually here in my new office, courtesy of coronavirus. I've had to move out of my house. I'm in a new place, but I'm all set up and ready to go.
Fantastic. Now, Sarah, since our last chat, we've actually had lots of new listeners find the podcast, which is fabulous. So would you mind introducing yourself again and telling our listeners just a little bit about yourself and about your background?
Yes, of course. So I live in Oxfordshire, near Oxford in England, and I guess I have loved visiting old places, you know, castles and manors, since my parents basically toured me around the whole of England every single summer, visiting every single National Trust property I think there's possible to visit. And I think that just got into me an absolute love for English history and places in particular. And then combine that with my love and I think a lot of people out there will understand when I say obsession with Anne Boleyn and the Tudors. I actually came to write about Anne Boleyn back in 2010, 2011. And I suppose that's when my private love became public. I came out of the Tudor closet, so to speak. Yeah, and I got onto Facebook and got onto social media and wrote that first novel, Le Temps Viendra, a novel of Anne Boleyn. And actually, it was through researching that novel, I was really wanting to get as much historical detail and accuracy about the events and the places in which the events took place, that my real research interest in Tudor places took form. And that's when we met, Natalie, of course. And yeah, as a result of that, two books, In the Footsteps of Anne Boleyn and In the Footsteps of the Six Wives, followed. And then I suppose taking that on one step further, I then created, I think it was back in sort of March, April, oh, it's nearly my second birthday, the Tudor Travel Guide was born. And the Tudor Travel Guide is my online online blog, my hub, where I share my obsession with Tudor buildings and hopefully help people connect to the past by informing folk about all these wonderful places, their history, and tie that in with the events and the people who lived there, the events that took place there, and generally act as a resource for people who are maybe planning on coming to the UK to visit Tudor places, or people living here who just want to get deeper into our history. And so now there's not only the Tudor Travel Guide blog, but I have my YouTube channel and publish regularly on there. And of course, my own podcast, The Tudor Travel Show, which is enormous fun because coronavirus aside, I normally get a chance to get out and about and tour and record at these various locations with local experts on hand.
You definitely have been busy in these last few years, haven't you?
Yes, I don't think I've had a moment to myself.
Now, last time you were on the show, which I actually can't believe, was the very first episode of Talking Tudors back in July 2018. Doesn't time fly?
It does.
Amazing. We actually chatted on that day about our shared love of Tudor palaces and other Tudor historic sites. But today, because this is part of our All Things Boleyn series, you're here to tell us about Anne Boleyn's coronation procession. So from the Tower of London to Westminster Hall. So let's dive straight in. When did this triumphant event take place?
Yes, and I'd like to say I'm so delighted to be talking about such a happy event. You know, one of the happiest periods in Anne Boleyn's life. So that has put a smile on my face. So thank you for inviting me to talk about that. And I think what I'll say is that the whole thing began on the 29th of May, and Anne was at Greenwich Palace. And of course, she processed amidst an enormous flotilla of barges up the Thames to the Tower of London. She was, of course, as you rightly point out, en route to Westminster at the time. Now, it was obviously a tradition that the monarch would stay at the Tower for a couple of days prior to processing through the city towards Westminster. And of course, that procession would normally go from the Tower down the Strand, which was the main thoroughfare that linked the City of London with the royal enclave of Westminster, and of course Westminster Abbey and the Old Palace of Westminster, etc. So having arrived at the Tower, Anne was there over 2 days from the 29th of May to her departure on the 31st. And of course, as you might expect, there was an awful lot of celebration and feasting and some various ceremonies which were traditionally associated with the coronation celebrations. And perhaps we'll come on to talk about that in a moment.
Yes, absolutely. We're going to do that. But first, I thought let's go back in time a little. Could you give us a bit of a snapshot of the milestones in Henry and Anne's relationship up until this point in time?
Yes, absolutely, I can. Now, we need to wind right the way back, of course, to the beginning of their relationship. And of course, there is some controversy about when exactly Henry and Anne fell in love and when Anne finally accepted or agreed to marry Henry. And I suppose if you look at two of the main historians who have hypothesized around the different dates in this, you can look at either David Starkey or Professor Ives. Now, David Starkey talks specifically about a letter that Henry VIII wrote to Anne, in which he thanks Anne for sending a gift to him. And the gift was a ship in which there was a damsel and a solitary diamond which hung down from the jewel. And basically that, as Tudor jewels was often the case with Tudor jewels, there was a lot of symbolism in that. So the boat represented, if you like, the ark, something that provided protection. Of course, the solitary damsel within it was needing the protection. And the diamond was very often associated with enduring love. And I think historians have interpreted that as basically Anne saying to Henry that she is giving herself to him. But there are slightly different interpretations on that. And in this letter, according to David Starkey, Henry talks about this word étrenne, which can mean gift, but Starkey has read that as meaning actually a New Year's gift. And therefore, he has said that, in fact, it was on New Year's Day, 1527, that Anne agreed to be Henry's wife. And also, if you think about the same letter, Henry is saying that he's been struck by the dart of love for over a year, and therefore Starkey is putting the date of their romance somewhere towards the end of 1525. Now, Professor Eric Ives has a slightly different take on that same word, étrenne. He interprets it as it being more of a special gift, a special occasion, but not necessarily a New Year's gift. And in fact, that it might also have been a metaphor for virginity, and that in fact, this gift was Anne just saying she was giving her maidenhood into the king's hands. And he prefers to think that the couple agreed to marry in the summer of 1527. Certainly by later on in the summer of 1527, when Henry applied to the Pope for a dispensation to marriage, they'd certainly agreed to marry by that stage. So we don't quite know exactly when the relationship started, but the earliest, late 1525 or possibly later on in 1527. But either way, they had definitely agreed to marry by the late summer of 1527. And of course, we then go into this long period of time. We have this, I think it's Eric Ives talks as this, a ménage à trois between Henry and Anne and Catherine of Aragon, and this epic battle of the king's great matter. But nevertheless, perhaps, obviously, Catherine's exile from court was probably another major milestone in their relationship. And certainly by September 1532, Anne is preparing to go with Henry over to France to meet Francis I as, you know, the king's queen in waiting, essentially. And of course, on the 1st of September, Henry elevates Anne to be Marquess of Pembroke, and so she is therefore raised to the peerage in her own right, which gives her the kind of status that she might need to go with Henry and to be presented to the king and other ladies of the French court, etc. So they head over to Calais around the sort of October time and have a wonderful time in Calais, of course, meet with the French king. Francis accepts Anne as the sort of de facto queen in waiting, and then they make preparations to come back. But of course, there is this enormous storm going on at the time, and that keeps the two of them holed up in Calais for around 3 weeks at the Exchequer, which was where the couple stayed. And, you know, I think many historians postulate that of course, this is where the pair consummated their marriage. And having potentially done that, they headed back across, they managed to get back across the channel on the 14th of November, which is St. Erkenwald's Day. They land in Dover. And of course, according to the chronicler Edward Hall, it was on St. Erkenwald's Day that the couple got married. Now, that's a bit confusing, of course, because there is this other date the following year, the 25th of January, 1533, where there is another account of Anne and Henry marrying in secret in a sort of pre-dawn ceremony in the Holbein Gate of the Palace of Westminster. I don't know. I tend to think that if there was some sort of ceremony in the November on St. Erkenwald's Day, maybe it was almost like a betrothal of kinds, and that the ceremony that followed later in January the following year was, if you like, the official marriage. But of course, if two people had become betrothed and had consummated the relationship in Tudor England, they were, of course, considered by the church to be married. So there we have it. We have actually Anne, of course, I forgot of one very important point. Anne got pregnant very quickly, and certainly by the Christmas of 1532, she probably knew that she was with child, and that may explain why you get this sudden acceleration of events with her official marriage in early 1533. And then, of course, Henry desperately wanting to see Anne crowned before the birth of the child, so everything could be seen as completely legit and above board.
Absolutely. Now, Sarah, after the long, drawn out years of waiting, Anne's coronation was obviously a huge triumph for the couple. Our wonderful Professor Eric Ives states that it was, in fact, the first major exhibition of civic pageantry since 1522, which is when Charles V made his entry into London, and only the second of its kind in the whole reign. So this is a huge deal, not just to them as a couple, but to the whole city, really. So tell us a little bit about the preparations for Anne's coronation.
Yeah, I mean, I think in many ways it's not unlike today, is it? I mean, there's so much preparation that goes on for these great royal events, and I suspect it was, very much the same for Anne's coronation. So it, as you point out, it's a huge event. Great significance. Henry really wanted everything to be, all the I's dotted and the T's crossed, because he wanted everybody to know that Anne Boleyn was his legitimate wife. And I'm actually recording a lot about the Field of Cloth of Gold at the moment, and that the speed at which everything was prepared for the Field of Cloth of Gold. And I think the same could be said, actually, of the preparations for Anne Boleyn's coronation. There was a matter of weeks, really, to get everything together before she was crowned on the Whit Sunday, the 1st of June. So I suspect there was a good deal of, royal protocol, as I said, as there is today, which guided what needed to happen and in what order. And, there was the logistical issue as well of making sure that everyone was in the right place at the right time and was appropriately attired, and all the relative, the appropriate physical props of coronation, the theatre of coronation, were in place. And I suspect a good place to start talking about that might be even at the Tower itself, because of course within the Tower of London there was the Royal Palace, which was surrounded the inner ward of the palace. That was a medieval palace, and Henry, of course, as many people will know, had wanted those buildings upgraded for the coronation celebrations of Anne Boleyn. And so there was a big building program, I believe overseen by Cromwell, if I'm right, to refurbish and extend those apartments and to create a suite of lodgings that were, fit for his new queen. And then, of course, there were the preparations for the streets and the buildings actually along the coronation route itself, and the designing of pageants, which would all, was a very, very typical medieval Tudor celebration, series of pageants that were staged along any kind of great festival route, and certainly for any kind of coronation, that would fete the new queen as she moved from the Tower down to Westminster. And I suppose there are three key players which seem to have been drafted in to kind of stage this whole thing. And that was Nicholas Udall and John Leyland, who were drafted in to write verses in the Queen's honour. And then, of course, you have the genius of the 16th century, Hans Holbein, who was tasked with designing, if you like, the physical appearance of the sets upon which the various plays and the verses and the pageants would be enacted. And then if we go to Westminster, we could think about all the viewing galleries that needed to be erected, including within the Abbey itself and within the Great Hall of the Old Palace of Westminster, where there would be the coronation feast afterwards. There was this high platform and a canopy of estate under which Anne would dine. And, I can really envisage just this great number of workmen who'd been drafted in to work day and night. And we've seen that in other locations that we've written about before, Natalie. I'm minded of the King's Manor at Canterbury when Anne of Cleves was due to arrive, how there were accounts of workmen working into the night by candlelight to redecorate everywhere. And it wouldn't surprise me if that was the case here. And then perhaps the other thing to think about was, were you going to get the golden invitation? I presume that letters and invitations went out to the aristocracy and the prelates of the land, who all would have been busy dusting off their ceremonial robes or maybe even getting new garments made for the occasion.
Yes, and I think there were a couple of notable absences that I'm sure Henry and Anne noted carefully as well.
Yeah, maybe we'll talk just a little bit about a couple of those absences later, because they were fairly significant.
Absolutely. Now, so you've mentioned obviously lots of ceremonies happening at this time. The pageantry of Anne's coronation, as you said, was spread out over 4 days. So it's not just a day event, 4 days. Mm-hmm. On the first day, Anne was escorted by river from Greenwich Palace to the Tower, where a number of these ceremonies and rituals took place over a 48-hour period. So there's sometimes a little bit of confusion about the apartments at the Tower of London. So can you talk to us about where Anne was lodged during her stay?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, these are some of my favourite apartments, and I'm just so devastated that they no longer exist. If we still had them, it would be amazing. So let me explain. The Tower of London, like many medieval castles, had a large outer ward and then a smaller inner ward. And the inner ward was, the entrance was by the Cold Harbour Gate, which was right next to the White Tower. Today, that inner ward is covered by basically grass. Essentially, and I think the ravens are kept down in one corner of it, and there's a little restaurant and cafe. But in its day, if you went through that Cold Harbour Gate, you would be entering a closed courtyard with various courtiers, lodgings or offices on your right. And then in front of you would have been the medieval Great Hall. I think it was built in the 13th century, very similar, as we both know, to the Great Hall at Winchester, if people have seen that. And in fact, the Great Hall played its part during these celebrations. And I think we might come to that in a moment. And you basically accessed the royal lodgings through the Great Hall, the King's lodgings first, and then from the King's lodgings through to the Queen's lodgings, which occupied a whole range along one side of this inner ward. And as I say, all these apartments had been completely refurbished, and they overlooked, as I say, the inner ward on one side and then the privy gardens on the other. And I would just say that it's actually quite unusual that in the Tower, I can only think one other location where this is also the case. In the Tower, the rooms on the Queen's side were larger than on the King's side. The only other place being Oatlands Palace that I can think of where this arrangement is similar. And this just underlines the prestige that was given to Anne Boleyn during those celebrations, that Henry was prepared to go to those lengths and build apartments, build lodgings that were larger than his own.
Yeah, that's interesting. I actually didn't realise that. So thank you for sharing that information with us. So one of the rituals of coronation was the creation of Knights of the Bath. So can you tell us a little bit about this ceremony and who was actually knighted on this occasion?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned earlier, this was a ceremony that was traditional. It took place as part of the build up to the big event itself. And essentially in the case of Anne Boleyn, it took place on Friday the 30th of May and then overnight into the 31st of May, which was the day in which Anne Boleyn actually processed to Westminster. And it's perhaps useful just to say that the order of the Knights of the Bath is the second most notable and important order of chivalry in England after the Knights of the Garter. And in advance of Anne Boleyn's coronation, 18 new Knights of the Bath were dubbed by the King. And incidentally, one of those was Francis Weston, who became Sir Francis Weston. Now, Edward Hall, who is a chronicler of the event, describes that dinner was first of all served, with all the knights being guests of honour. They were then led to their chambers and were ceremonially bathed. There's no actual detailed account in Hall's description or any other 16th century description, as far as I know, of what actually happened. But luckily for us, there is an old account of the ceremony from the time of Henry IV's coronation, which was about 140 years earlier. And I think we could essentially rely on the fact that what happened then probably pretty much, well, happened 140 years later, Anne Boleyn's coronation. So what he said was that the knights were taken into basically, I think they were in a chamber in the White Tower, which is the main keep at the Tower of London. And each knight had their own bath, and they got into their bath, and then the king would process into the room and he inducted each of the knights by turn with words about the vows that they were due to uphold. And what the king then did is he dipped his finger in the water and made the sign of the cross upon their naked back. And then afterwards, the knights were dried off and they were dressed and they rested for a little while in a nearby bed. And each of those beds were kind of richly adorned. And then they were summoned a little while later by a curfew bell. And attendants then dressed the knights as monks. And they would then process to the Chapel of St. John, which, of course, is that beautiful Norman chapel in the White Tower. And their new armour and the insignia of the order awaited them. And the knights then kept vigil near the high altar for the rest of the night until the morning, when they would miraculously emerge as new Knights of the Bath. And then I think Hall picks up the story by saying that at 8 a.m., those new knights were received in the Great Hall, which is the Great Hall that we've just been talking about. And they had their golden spurs and their gilded belts on, and they were then dubbed by the king. And as it happens, also just by the by, a further 48 knights bachelor were also created at that ceremony. And then there was a big celebratory dinner in the Queen's apartments, and sometime after that, Anne clearly made ready for her grand processional entry into the city. So quite a day, quite a lot going on.
And that's goodness, even before... I'm exhausted just listening to you talk about.
I know. I always think, gosh, it must have been such a long day for her at 6 months pregnant. We haven't even set off for the tower, you know, for Westminster yet. Anyway. You know, maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that too.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do that. So on Saturday, 31st of May, and as you mentioned, processed from the Tower to Westminster. So Sarah, who took part and who didn't take part, and what was the Queen to be wearing at that point?
Okay, well, what I thought I would do is start with what she was wearing, first of all, and then maybe go on and talk about the procession itself and who was in the procession, and then maybe a little bit about who wasn't there. So, you know, I like to think of the 31st of May as being a glorious sunny day. Just ignore the fact that it always rains in England. It was a gloriously sunny day. And she emerges from her apartment with her dark auburn hair and dark eyes. And she is dressed in a gown of white cloth of gold and a coif which is made of white silk in the French style. And I quote, cross-barred with gold cord and edged with passement. Now, I can kind of see what that might, I'm thinking that might look like a lattice arrangement. Yes. I'm not entirely sure, but that's my interpretation of it. And then a coronet was placed over this coif. And I think if I'm right in saying, with the exception of the actual crown of St. Edward the Confessor that was used to crown her, all the coronets were made specific, that were worn by Anne during this period, were made for her. That's just something I'm sort of dragged up from the back of my mind. So sorry if I do have that rough feeling that that was the case. So you're thinking, look, this sort of swarthy coloured skin, this dark raven coloured hair, dark eyes, and this shimmering white and gold. I mean, she would have just looked resplendent. And then on top of that, she gets into a litter, which is also covered in white satin and white cloth of gold. So the Tudors really knew how to use colour and how to make, you know, the person who should be in the limelight stand out. And she must have really stood out. Now, the procession itself always, this makes my mind boggle, Nat, because the procession was 2.5 miles long. And I always think, how on earth did they arrange everybody in the tower? For, you know, they must have had, I don't know, did they all snake around the outer wall? You know, how did they actually just physically get it together? But, you know, one assumes that maybe it was assembled from the outer gate and then, you know, everybody just took up their place and the litter waited for Anne, you know, outside the Cold Harbour Gate. And she was able to get into that. Anyway, let me tell you a little bit more about that litter. I mean, I've said it was furnished with white satin and white cloth of gold. She was seated in the litter. She was seated beneath a canopy of cloth of gold, which was carried by the four wardens of the Cinque-Ports. And it wasn't on wheels. So it had poles that were sort of slotted into harnesses that were carried by, I think, white palfreys. So again, just this vision of white. But in terms of the actual procession itself, let's think about who preceded her. Well, there were about 400 gentlemen preceding her walking in pairs, and the household of the French ambassador came first. So I presume this is a nod to Anne's connection with France and how France has been supportive of the marriage. And so they had the honour of heading the procession. Then we had gentlemen of the King's Privy Household. There were 9 judges in scarlet velvet, and then came the newly created Knights of the Bath that we'd just been talking about, and they were all also in scarlet robes with hoods of Miniver. And then we've got some high-ranking men of the church, which were followed by the marquesses, earls, barons, who were all mounted on horseback. And then getting a little closer to Anne, we've got the Venetian ambassador, who was accompanied by the Archbishop of York, and then behind them, Thomas Cranmer as Archbishop of Canterbury, who was riding alongside the French ambassador. Directly in front of Anne, we've got the mayor of the City of London, a certain Christopher Askew, and he was carrying the ceremonial mace, which is a symbol of power, of, in this case, I guess, the City of London. And then directly in front of Anne, we've got the 23-year-old Lord William Howard, who is Anne's uncle. Now, he is standing in for one of the people who isn't there, and that's Thomas Howard, Duke of Norfolk. Now, the Dukes of Norfolk were, and in fact still are, as far as I know, the Earl Marshals of England, and they sort of presided over great events, as he was to do over Anne Boleyn's trial in 3 years later in 1536. Now, he had been sent away with actually George Boleyn to France on a diplomatic mission just days before the coronation. And just as an aside there, I do often wonder how Anne felt having her dearly beloved brother not with her on one of the most important days of her life, but that's another story. And riding next to Lord William Howard was Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk. He was there as the High Constable. Then we've got Anne in her litter. And then behind Anne, we have the aristocratic ladies carried in 2 more litters. That included Anne's step-grandmother, the 56-year-old Agnes, Dowager Duchess of Norfolk. Oh, that's a bit of a tongue tire. And the 47-year-old Margaret, Dowager of Dorset. And then we've got more chariots following, some of them furnished in white cloth, another with red cloth. And we have a train of around 30 women all dressed in velvet and silk, in the colours of the ladies they were attending, all following behind. And then right at the end, at the tail end of the procession, we've got the Master of the Guard and the attendant constables all dressed in velvet with damask coats. And I guess just to say one final thing, I've talked about 2 people who weren't there for good reason. But one person who just simply refused to be there was, of course, Mary Tudor, Henry VIII's sister, who, well, hated Anne Boleyn. I think there's no other way of saying it. She, as the ex-Queen of France, refused to for Anne to take precedence over her. So she wasn't there. But of course, we've also got to remember she wasn't there because she was also very ill. I mean, in fact, she was dying, and she would go on to die at her home at Westhorpe Hall, where she was in Suffolk, I think towards the end of the month.
Sarah, what an incredible feast for the eyes. I'm just, you know, if I could travel back to one point, I think it would have to be Anne's coronation. That would just be unbelievable to witness, wouldn't it?
Oh, my goodness, wouldn't it? And all that wine flowing as well to go with it. Yes. It would be amazing.
I want to ask you about the public's reaction. I know this is a little bit controversial, and it kind of depends which account you rely on, but what was the public's reaction to this incredible spectacle?
Yeah, I mean, I feel that when you talk about this, you have to kind of toe the middle line, I suppose, which is, I think it's probably mixed. And I can believe it was probably mixed. You know, Anne had displaced who many people saw as Henry's rightful queen. And, you know, she'd been banished. She was in exile. She'd only recently been, you know, officially, you know, the marriage declared null and void. I mean, that was a close run thing. But that's, again, another story. But, you know, I think women in particular really probably resented her and felt threatened by this turn of events. Because, you know, if Henry VIII could just cast aside his wife of over 20 years, who happened also to be the daughter of a powerful European monarch, a queen in her own right. Well, goodness me, what might that mean for their own marriages? So I can imagine that there was, you know, a fair number of people feeling disgruntled. And then I guess there were others who just, you know, were very happy. Maybe they were, you know, they were supported the reformed faith. Maybe they saw this as a new beginning, a bright new beginning. And there were probably people there who were just there to have a wonderful time because, you know, it was a time of celebration. And they probably didn't care as long as they had a great day and the wine flowed, which, as I have pointed out, it absolutely did. So I think, you know, there are accounts of Anne complaining to Henry that some people, you know, kept their hats on their heads and they didn't show her enough deference and respect. But I think at the end of, you know, I think most people would also say that, you know, Anne was never really the people's queen.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. I think that spectacle would have been awe-inspiring. So some people may have, and the wine may have assisted to forget exactly what happened coming up to that event. But yeah, all right. So you've mentioned that obviously this processional route was quite a long one and there were lots of stops and lots of pageantry and things. Can you tell us about some of the highlights, I guess, or some of the stops on this coronation route?
Yeah, I certainly can. So as I mentioned before, the whole route was prepared in advance because obviously the route was going through the City of London, narrow Tudor streets on the whole, smelly, dirty, not a lot of sanitation. You don't want that when the Queen of England is being crowned. So, you know, we need to clean up our act. So I think, as was often the case in these kind of ceremonies, roads were swept and they were gritted, and I quote, against the Queen's coming. Many of the buildings then, if you think about these buildings in these cramped streets, and some of them, you know, are three or four stories high, were decorated with arras or tapestries, carpets, cloth of gold and silver and other rich fabrics. And the Eleanor Cross in Cheapside, and Cheapside was the main sort of east-west thoroughfare running through the City of London, which was probably also, I think, the widest street, had some of the most spectacular houses on it. Also had these conduits in it and the Eleanor Cross. Now, the Eleanor Cross had been repainted and it had been hung with coats of arms, and the streets would have been packed. And I think to get a sense of that, it's perhaps useful to go and have a look at the painting of the coronation procession of Edward VI, which shows him making his way from the Tower down Cheapside. And it just gives us a really good idea of how it would have looked on that May morning. And I think, you know, whether people were pro or against the new Queen, curiosity itself would have surely brought them out onto the streets. And I think you can see in this painting, you know, there are people hanging out of windows and on rooftops overlooking the procession, trying to just get a glimpse of, you know, the new Queen. And then, as I mentioned, we had these conduits in the street, and it was again tradition that they would flow with wine freely, as they did on this particular May day. Now, the other thing which also I think you're particularly referring to are the pageants, Natalie. We've talked about all the preparation that went into writing and staging them. And this was, you know, pageants, a series of pageants was really typical of any great Tudor entry. And we saw it, for example, when Catherine of Aragon entered the city when she came to marry Arthur Tudor in 1501. And here we have it repeated for Anne Boleyn's coronation. Now, fertility and kind of the importance of the Queen in propagating the royal line was always featured heavily in these various pageants, as they did in this instance. But I think for me, personally, one of my favourite pageants was staged outside the old Gothic St Paul's Cathedral. And here Anne would have pulled up, and there was a pageant where there was a virgin dressed in white and holding a gold tablet in her hands. And written upon the tablet was the phrase, and here comes my Latin, Vini Amica Cora Corona Beris. Vini Amica Corona Beris. There you go. It's a long time since I've studied Latin, so my apologies for any fluent speakers out there. Anyway, what it means in English is, come, my love, thou shalt be crowned. And I know you and I have spoken about this before and how personal that phrase is, that's the one moment in this procession where it feels to me that Anne is speaking directly, Henry is speaking directly to Anne in a really intimate way, in amongst all this very public celebration. And it, for me, it underlines the great love which had brought the two together in that point. And, you know, obviously, as everybody knows, the course of their love was certainly not straightforward, and it must have felt like a really personal triumph. And I think that this pageant speaks to that more than any others. From there, the procession would have left the city via Ludgate and travelled down the Strand, which was the swanky Tudor residential part. Anybody who's anybody had a house on the Strand, to reach Charing Cross, and the royal stables were sited at the top of Charing Cross. And then the procession would have continued down King Street, which today, of course, is called Whitehall, under the Holbein Gate, and then on into the royal enclave of Westminster and to Westminster Hall.
Wow, an absolutely exhausting day for Anne. I'm sure, like, triumphant and really joyful for her, but how exhausting for somebody, you know, 6 months pregnant. That's incredible.
I mean, I hate to be a bit base about it, but she must have been dying for the loo.
I know. I wonder if they did some pit stops along the way that we don't hear about.
They did. It's one of those kind of silly little details that just make things, how did that work? But anyway, yes, she must have been relieved to arrive at Westminster Hall, because, of course, then she was able, after being officially received, she was able to slip out the back into a barge and then headed up to the Palace of Whitehall to meet with Henry. She stayed at Whitehall, and then again in the morning, getting into a barge, going back, kind of back on herself, back to the old palace of Westminster, where she would have alighted and kind of had a behind the scenes, no doubt, you know, got ready to come into the Great Hall, which is where everybody amassed on the morning of the 1st of June, the morning of her coronation. And that's where she set out to walk to the Abbey, again, as tradition dictated.
Now, Sarah, you and I, we absolutely love walking in the footsteps of the Tudors. We've done it many times before. So what are some places in London that we can visit when we're allowed to leave our homes, that is, associated with Anne's coronation?
Yeah, it's something to look forward to, isn't it? When we're all released,
absolutely,
again.
Yeah.
We'll be running around like maniacs. Anyway, yeah, so I've mentioned many of, you know, a few of them, but let me reiterate. Yep. Of course, the Tower of London, you can see the kind of remains of the royal lodgings. There's not much. And when I say remains, I mean some, you know, foundation footings in the ground, but you can go and stand where Anne's royal lodgings once were. But of course, if you go into the keep itself, into the Chapel of St. John, that's absolutely still there. And it's just the most beautiful, peaceful, beguiling space. I missed it for many years. And then once I'd got interested in the Tudors and I'd written about it for Le Temps Viendre and I went in there, I was like, wow, how did this pass me by? So I think it's one of the oldest chapel spaces, you know, in London, perhaps alongside St. Bartholomew the Great. So that's really worthwhile seeing. And then, of course, you can walk the procession route. And of course, we wrote about this procession route in the footsteps of Anne Boleyn.
Yes.
And so it is actually there in the book, and you can take that book with you and you can follow the route. So you can do that. And then, of course, you have Westminster Hall, which by some miracle has survived fires and bombing, and it is still there, a real survivor of time. It is really easily missed. A lot of people go to see the Abbey. And of course, the rest of the old Palace of Westminster was burnt down in the Victorian period, but somehow Westminster Hall survived. But a lot of people miss that it's there. And you can't always get to it. Depends when Parliament's sitting, etc. But if you can get to it, it's worth it, because as you walk through those doors that Anne Boleyn herself walked through, you walk into the most magnificent space with the largest hammer beam roof in England. I think it was Richard II, forgive me if I get that wrong, that created that way back in the medieval period. And it really takes your breath away. It's such a historic space. So I really recommend that. And then, of course, there is Westminster Abbey just across the road, where you can see now the coronation chair. It's beautifully displayed. I think in the last couple of years they've created this really nice presentation of the chair, all lit up, and that's the, you know, go and stand as close to the Cosmati pavement as possible, which is where all monarchs are crowned, and drink in the atmosphere.
And I remember you and I visiting Westminster Hall, and it was just spectacular, wasn't it? I think our jaws were just off the floor.
I couldn't believe that, again, I couldn't believe that I'd missed it so long. And I was just like, oh, yeah, literally, I think my jaw was literally hanging open. I was just going, oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
You get a bit of a sore neck, don't you, from Sarah?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sarah, thank you so much. You've painted an absolutely spectacular picture of these events. And it's so wonderful leading up to our next episode, which is going to be about the actual coronation. So that's really exciting. Mm. So, before I let you go, I can't let you run away just yet. We're going to finish all things Boleyn episodes by asking the guest for a Boleyn takeaway. This time I normally ask for a Tudor takeaway, but I thought let's ask for a Boleyn takeaway. So do you have one for us today?
Yeah, I do. I'm cheating a little bit. I'm cheating, I must admit.
I'll let you cheat. That's all right.
I think my takeaway probably covers both. It's probably a Tudor takeaway, and if you want it to be, it can be a Boleyn takeaway. But there is nothing more wonderful and revealing and exciting than reading contemporary accounts or accounts that were written as close to the event as possible. Because what tends to happen, you know, is obviously as historians write about these things over time, they take little snippets and they maybe change the words a bit. And that's all fine. And I'm certainly not criticizing that at all. But there's been many times I've gone back to read the original and there's been something I've been interested in that somebody hasn't mentioned, or a certain phrasing that sheds a whole new light. And you're able to transport yourself back in a way that I think you don't always do with later, you know, historical kind of biographies, etc. So I would like to commend to your audience Edward Hall's Chronicle. If people haven't read it, the beauty of it is that it is available freely online. So you can go search for it and you can download it. And you can read about some of these things in more Tudor speak, which is much more authentic. And so that's my takeaway.
And that's a fabulous takeaway. And Sarah, thank you so much for joining us again on Talking Tudors. It's been wonderful having you back, and I hope to have you back again in the future.
Thank you, Natalie. It's been an absolute pleasure. Always lovely to talk to you.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.